This is the intro for the Decatur Herald and Review, Part 1.
Good afternoon. This is Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review. It's Wednesday, December 11th. We'll start with the front page, with an article about the Decatur Bicycle Club, headlined, Reading Bikes to Find Holiday Homes. We have a photo of various bicycles displayed at the Decatur Bicycle Shop on Tuesday. Repairs made before donating to Christmas Toy Shop, Salvation Army. From Donette Beckett in Decatur. A few local children will find a bicycle under their Christmas trees this year, all from the help of people who know a few things about bicycles. The Decatur Bicycle Club pays local bike shops to repair bikes before they are donated to the community Christmas toy shop, said bike club member Ralph Zerwinski. They put them in top running order, he said, then we donate them to the Salvation Army. The toy shop will be held next week. The Decatur Bicycle Club partners with the shops to coordinate bike programs. Scott Magruder, owner of the Decatur Bicycle Shop located on Pershing Road, fixes up bikes before members of the club come to pick them up for the holiday giveaway. Those are bikes that have come through here that people have either traded in or donated, he said. I fix them up and get them ready to put in their hands so they can find the right homes for them. Magruder hunts for the right bikes throughout the year. This year, the Decatur Bicycle Shop was able to donate 3 children's bikes. I try to hold on to as many as I can, Magruder said. Some years, more than others come in. The program was created to encourage cycling throughout the community, according to members. The group was able to collect $1,500 for the repair of the older bikes and the purchase of new bikes at a local department store. According to Matt Roof, president of the Decatur Bicycle Club, the holiday program is part of a founding principle of philanthropy and to promote cycling-related activities in the community. This is something we've done for a number of years now, he said. At 76 members, the Decatur Bicycle Club is considered small, Roof said. We are a social club. We're not racers, he said. We're just a group of people that like to get together that happen to like bicycle riding. The funds for the holiday program were raised through the annual ride held in Arthur. Next year will be the 40th ride, Roof said. We have people who have come every year for decades, he said. It's very popular, with nice roads, beautiful scenery. For those interested in joining the club, information is available on the club's website. We welcome all riders of all skill levels and all types of bicycles, Roof said. Again from the front page, under local entertainment, the beat goes on for musician Matt Carter. Matt Carter, 54, plays every show like it's his last. When you're doing something, you don't ever think of it being the last time you do it, the Decatur man said. As the lead of the Matt Carter Band and a liver transplant recipient, Carter is happy to be performing again. His next show will be as the opening act for Solid Gold on Friday at the Lincoln Square Theater. Carter received his new liver in 2019. The experience, including 3 close calls with death, changed his perspective on life as well as his music. I'm glad that I got baptized, he said, because prayer really helped me. After emerging from the coma, Carter learned his hearing had been permanently damaged. It was like being on a 12-hour jet flight, he said. You know, when you try to pop your ears. The pandemic made the recovery more challenging, he said. Everybody's going to put a mask on, and you've spent a year learning to read lips, Carter said. It was depressing. Because his immune system was weak, Carter had to keep his distance from the public. While he was sick, Carter dreamt of the things he could do just one more time, including eating a Crekel burger. But I wanted to play one more show, he said. The first Matt Carter Band reunion, months after his surgery, didn't go well, according to Carter. I sounded like crap, he said. We didn't play again until 2021. His friends and family continued to encourage him. Carter said he needed to learn how to play guitar again because of the scarring from the surgery, as well as the loss of hearing. He learned different techniques to help with both challenges. Music has always been my psychiatrist, Carter said. It's not like I make money at it. Carter's paying job was working with production crews for other shows throughout the country. Through the strains on his body as well as the alcohol to relax at the end of the day, Carter would use various painkillers. Thus, his liver was damaged. A few of the friends to help Carter out were members of Decatur band Solid Gold. The members of Solid Gold asked them to be part of the show for one reason. Because they're awesome, said bass player Vic Zentara, and he's very good at what he does. Zentara also played with the Matt Carter Band during the summer for a few shows. It's good to sit in with a familiar friend, he said, and it's a great band. Solid Gold performs soft rock music. The Matt Carter Band performs original music. They have a great following, Zentara said. They're a good fit with us. Lavelle Hunt, president of Friends of the Historic Lincoln Square Theater, has heard Carter perform, but not at the Downtown Theater. He's tried to play at the Lincoln several times, but we just didn't have the right fit, Hunt said, because I try to fit the right genres of music up. Solid Gold became a popular opening act for other performers, including the Little River Band and Pablo Cruz at the now-revamped Lincoln Square Theater. After the 70s soft classic band was given its own headlining show, Solid Gold chose the Matt Carter Band as their special guest. Carter is ready to be on stage. We're wanting to get in as much music as we can in such a short period of time, he said about Friday's show. I'm just always glad to do it one more time, but I won't be jumping off the stage or anything like that. If you go to the concert, Solid Gold with special guest Matt Carter Band will be playing at 7 p.m. Friday, December 13th at Lincoln Square Theater, 141 North Main Street, Decatur. Tickets $15 to $25. Visit the Lincoln Square Theater website or call 217-454-4583. Continuing with our local and state news from A3. Heartland Community College from Lincoln. HCC in Lincoln enrolling students in welding classes. Heartland Community College in Lincoln is now enrolling students in welding classes. The program provides more opportunities for Logan County students while also maintaining the welding skills and industrial technology offerings on the main campus in Normal, according to a news release. Welding is an in-demand career in Logan County, and Heartland is excited to provide the training locally for students to enter the workforce in just 4 months, Heartland Community College Lincoln Director Jennifer Kirby stated in the news release. Lincoln welding classes will be held in the spring 2025 semester, beginning with an 8-week 100-level intro course. Students will be able to advance to a 200-level advanced course after the completion of the first. Students completing the two-course sequence will earn the Gas Metal Arc Welding Basics Micro Certificate and will be eligible to complete the larger 16-hour welding skill certificate. The welding skill certificate is stackable into a larger industrial technology applied Associate of Science degree. Scholarship opportunities are available for this program. For more information on welding courses or other questions, email lincoln.center@heartland.edu or call 217-735-1731. From Macon County Courts, Decatur man denies prostitution, other charges, from Tony Reed in Decatur. A Decatur man is denying charges that he beat, strangled, and forced a woman to work as a prostitute. A grand jury returned the charges against Ashante D. Brownlee, 47, who was arrested November 8th and appeared November 13th in Macon County Circuit Court for arraignment. The defendant remains in the custody of the Macon County Jail after Judge Lindsay Shelton said he posed too great a threat to the public to be allowed free on pretrial release. The charges accuse Brownlee of promoting prostitution in that said defendant knowingly compelled the victim to become a prostitute. He is further accused of having knowingly arranged a situation to ensure the victim became a prostitute. All the charges involve the same victim and allege she was beaten, strangled, and raped by the defendant, who also held her in a bedroom against her will. In addition, Brownlee is charged with vehicular invasion and various weapons offenses. These include possession of a weapon by a felon, in that said defendant, a person who has been convicted of a forcible felony, being attempted murder in Cook County, knowingly possessed a handgun. Brownlee is also pleading not guilty to all these offenses and is due back in court for a pretrial hearing January 28th. Now from our national and world news page, A7, study looks at drugstore closings, Tom Murphy from the Associated Press. Nearly three out of 10 U.S. drugstores that were open during the previous decade closed by 2021, new research shows. Black and Latino neighborhoods were most vulnerable to the retail pharmacy closures, which can chip away at already limited care options in those communities, researchers said in a study published this week in Health Affairs. The trend potentially gained momentum since the study's time frame because many drugstores are still struggling. In the past 3 years, the major chains Walgreens and CVS closed hundreds of additional stores, and Rite Aid shrank as it went through a bankruptcy reorganization. Drugstores have been dealing with shrinking reimbursement for prescriptions, rising costs, and changing customer shopping habits. The chains closed money-losing stores and transferred prescription files to more profitable locations. The study found more than 29% of the nearly 89,000 retail U.S. pharmacies that operated between 2010 and 2020 closed by 2021. That amounts to more than 26,000 stores. Researchers using data from the National Council for Prescription Drug Programs found the number of U.S. pharmacies actually increased from 2010 to 2017 because of store openings, but the pace of closings picked up starting in 2018. They also highlighted which stores were more likely to close. Those include independent pharmacies, which were more likely than chain stores to be in Black, Latino, and low-income neighborhoods. Pharmacies in neighborhoods with higher rates of patients on government-funded Medicaid and Medicare also were at greater risk for closing, said Di Mercato, a University of Southern California pharmacy professor who was the study's lead author. Those programs tend to reimburse less than private health insurance. Researchers also noted the exclusion of some pharmacies, particularly independent drugstores, from pharmacy benefit manager networks can hurt. That can mean fewer prescriptions and customers visit for those stores. Retail drugstores can be important sources for vaccinations, contraception, overdose prevention, and opioid use disorder treatments, in addition to prescriptions, Cato said. And now part one of our opinion page, Beg Your Pardon, from Phil Morris, who is the opinion editor for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Biden wrong to choose his son over his country. In the history of presidential pardons, the absolution granted to Hunter Biden by President Joe Biden stands alone. This clemency will register as one of the shameful culminating acts of a good man and father, now inelegantly exiting the West Wing. The crimes committed by Hunter Biden, the youngest son of Joe Biden, are far from the most heinous ever to elicit the mercy of a U.S. president. Presidents have extended pardons to war criminals, and it's not historically rare for a president to pardon someone who shares a direct family bloodline, though this is the first time a president has bestowed the extraordinary forgiveness to a direct progeny. What makes the president's pardon historically consequential is that it's a pardon Joe Biden said on several occasions he wouldn't offer. He didn't equivocate. So now we're left to question whether Joe Biden simply changed his mind or deliberately misled the American public in the heat of an election campaign from which he had yet to withdraw. When President Biden told the American public he would accept the will of the jury, which convicted Hunter Biden on gun charges earlier this year, he was clear. He vowed to respect the rule of law as our best leaders do. I'm extremely proud of my son, Hunter, Joe Biden said after the conviction. He has overcome an addiction. He is one of the brightest, most decent men I know. I abide by the jury decision. I will do that, and I will not pardon him. Jurors found Hunter Biden guilty in June of lying to a federally licensed gun dealer, making a false claim on the application by saying he was not a drug user, and illegally possessing a gun for 11 days. At the time of his pardon, he had yet to be sentenced. Before the pardon, Hunter Biden was also scheduled to face a judge to be sentenced on a felony tax evasion guilty plea. The false equivalencies have begun in earnest. Shortly after Joe Biden's grant of clemency was announced Sunday, President-elect Donald Trump wrote the following post on the Truth Social platform. Does the pardon given by Joe to Hunter include the January 6th hostages, who have now been in prison for years, Trump wrote? Such an abuse and miscarriage of justice. A spokesman for the Trump transition team offered additional perspective in defense of Trump, who was found guilty of 34 felony charges related to a hush money payment to a porn actress in the 2016 campaign. The cases involving Trump and Hunter Biden bear no comparison, but that hasn't prevented either side from arguing that they are victims of a politicized Department of Justice. The failed witch hunts against President Trump have proved that the Democrat-controlled DOJ and other radical prosecutors are guilty of weaponizing the justice system, Trump's incoming White House Communications Director Stephen Chung said in a statement to Fox News. That system of justice must be fixed and due process must be restored for all Americans, which is exactly what President Trump will do as he returns to the White House with an overwhelming mandate from the American people, Chung said. It's a false equivalency. Trump and a group of his supporters attempted to overturn a fair and free election. He branded the January 6 protesters and associated insurrectionists as patriots, and now may soon use his sweeping constitutional powers to grant them the same courtesy that Joe Biden granted his son. At least Trump has previously said he would consider pardons on a case-by-case basis. Even the sad spectacle of Trump potentially pardoning those who stormed the Capitol won't completely eclipse one of the final acts of Joe Biden as U.S. president. He chose his son over country. He did so despite his stated intent that he wouldn't. We'll read a second opinion on this topic in the second half of the Decatur Herald and Review for today. From Jason Meisner and Megan Krepo, Chicago Tribune, and the Madigan corruption trial. Sphinx? Court hears another Madigan nickname. U.S. Rep. Budzinski testifies as trial now in 10th week. The jury in Michael Madigan's corruption trial has heard many nicknames given to the powerful Democratic House Speaker, from the obvious like MJM or Mr. Speaker to the more esoteric such as himself and our friend. But on Monday they heard a new one, Sphinx. That was the moniker applied to Madigan by some members of J.B. Pritzker's team after Pritzker's election in 2018, according to U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, who was a top Pritzker aide before her election to Congress in 2022. The nickname, a reference to the mythical figure of Egyptian pharaohs typically used to convey strength and ferocity, was used in an email shown during Budzinski's testimony, referencing a job recommendation from Madigan for Pritzker's new administration. Attached is the most recent Sphinx list of recommendations ahead of your meeting today, read the December 4, 2018 email, which was sent from Budzinski to Pritzker and his soon-to-be chief of staff, Ann Caprara. We have noted these in our process and they are coming through our portal. It's not the first time Madigan was ever referred to as a sphinx in political circles. In fact, some of the speaker's own friends and colleagues sometimes called him the Sphinx from Pulaski Road, a nod to his 13th Ward headquarters at 65th and Pulaski. But Budzinski's testimony was the first the jury had heard of it. And while she confirmed that Sphinx was a reference to Madigan, she couldn't explain why. On cross-examination, Madigan's attorney, Laurie Dirks, asked if the Sphinx nickname was part of the myth of Madigan in Springfield. I can't really speak to that. It wasn't my nickname, Budzinski testified. The image of Madigan, a famously Irish Southwest sider, as a monumental desert colossus with the head of a human, body of a lion and wings of an eagle, brought some levity to an otherwise quick, cut-and-dried day of testimony in Madigan's trial, which is now in its 10th week. U.S. District Judge John Robert Blakey recessed the trial for the day after only an hour so that parties could attend services for longtime Seventh Circuit Judge Joel Flom, who passed away last week at age 88. Testimony was to resume Tuesday morning. Prosecutors have said they could rest their case in chief later this week. Madigan, 82, of Chicago, who served for decades as Speaker of the Illinois House and the head of the state Democratic Party, faces racketeering charges, alleging he ran his state and political operations like a criminal enterprise. He is charged alongside his longtime confidant, Michael McLean, 77, a former ComEd contract lobbyist from downstate Quincy. Both men have pleaded not guilty and denied wrongdoing. Budzinski, a Springfield Democrat elected to the U.S. House last year, was senior advisor to Pritzker in his 2018 campaign to unseat Governor Bruce Rauner and later was a key aide in Pritzker's new administration. When she took the stand Tuesday, Assistant U.S. Attorney Amarjit Bachchu asked her, "When you're not testifying in federal court, can you tell the jury what's your day job?" "I'm a United States representative," she said. "I represent the 13th District of Illinois in Congress." After Pritzker was elected in 2018, Budzinski became the executive director of the Transition Committee, helping to select, interview, and hire a number of individuals into state government and four boards and commissions. Pritzker had the final say on any hires, Budzinski said. The transition team set up a government portal where any applicants had to sign up, Budzinski said. Other candidates came through LinkedIn and also social media. They also took recommendations from elected officials and others in government. Budzinski said she was aware Madigan had been a legislative leader for a very long time and that they gave serious consideration to any job recommendation that came from him. But she said recommendations from any of four legislative leaders were in no way a slam dunk. "We had a lot of due diligence," Budzinski said. "We really took it very serious to vet every single candidate that was recommended." Jurors were shown one email from Budzinski to other Pritzker transition staff, saying they had a resume from a guy from New York seeking a position with the Illinois Department of Transportation that should have MJM on it. "We need to call him at least, and perhaps maybe consider him for number two spot," Budzinski wrote. According to the indictment, one of Madigan's recommendations was then Alderman Daniel Solis, who was working undercover for federal investigators and asked Madigan to help him get a state board position in Pritzker's administration as part of an FBI rise. But Budzinski was not asked specifically about Solis and her testimony, which lasted only about 30 minutes. From Robert Chanik, Chicago Tribune. Illinois better set for recession than in 07 or 20, study finds. While Fed monetary policy has so far managed to tame post-pandemic inflation without precipitating a recession, there is growing concern among some economists that planned tariffs and mass deportations under President-elect Donald Trump might endanger that soft landing. But if a recession does hit, Illinois is ready to cushion the fall, a new economic study found. The state is in better shape to withstand a downturn than it was during either the 2007 Great Recession or the 2020 COVID recession, according to the joint study published Monday by the Illinois Economic Policy Institute and the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. "No state in the nation is recession-proof," said report co-author Frank Manzo, an economist at the Illinois Economic Policy Institute, a LaGrange-based nonpartisan research organization. But Illinois is better positioned to overcome the challenges and withstand the forces that trigger recessions than at any point in recent history. The elimination of the general fund deficit and replenishing the state's rainy day fund with $2 billion led the list of post-pandemic improvements that should help Illinois weather a possible recession, with a little less pain than the previous two, the study found. Other improvements include a workshare program implemented in 21 that allows employers to avoid layoffs by temporarily reducing workers' hours while enabling them to receive prorated unemployment benefits. In addition, the state's 2019 Rebuild Illinois capital plan, bolstered by federal infrastructure funding during the Biden administration, will invest $41 billion in roads, bridges, rail, air, and public transit over the next 6 years, providing ongoing jobs and economic activity even through a downturn. The research shows that states which prioritize investments in skilled labor and infrastructure not only are more resilient, but also have higher growth rates, Manzo told the Tribune. So they do have better performing economies, regardless of whether they fall into recession or not. A post-pandemic recession seemed inevitable to many economists last year, after the Fed made 11 rate hikes over 16 months in an effort to curb inflation, which peaked at an annual rate of 9.1% in June 22, due largely to supply chain disruptions. Next week, with inflation hovering at about 2.5% and the economy relatively stable, the Fed will weigh its third rate cut since September, amid increasing optimism that a recession can be avoided. But a September report by the Peterson Institute for International Economics predicts that Trump's tariff and deportation policies will cause consumer prices to rise and inflation to spike to as high as 9.3% by 26, once again raising the specter of imminent recession. Manzo puts the odds of the recession during Trump's second term at about 30%, meaning Illinois needs to be ready. When there's a 30% chance of precipitation, most people pack an umbrella or bring a raincoat, Manzo said. And it's really no different for states which must work to create resilient economies that are prepared to weather the next downturn. Despite its improved recession resilience, Illinois is still grappling with significant economic problems, including its worst in the nation standing for unfunded pension liability and one of the highest corporate tax rates among the states, a competitive development disadvantage. Illinois has lost a number of big-name corporations to other states in the post-pandemic landscape, including billionaire hedge fund manager Ken Griffin's investment firm, Citadel, which moved from Chicago to Miami in 22. Other recent high-profile exits included Boeing and Caterpillar. Even in some economic areas in which it has improved, such as the Rainy Day Fund to keep the state operating during a downturn, which is up 700% since the Great Recession, Illinois still lags most other states, Manzo said. But the study did not compare Illinois to other states, only against itself as it navigated two recessions and the pandemic during the new millennium. And on that measure, Illinois is in much better financial shape with 9 upgrades from credit rating agencies since 21. For Illinois, employers and employees alike, the state's improved financial health could make a material difference when the next recession hits, according to report co-author Robert Bruno, a professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana and director of the Project for Middle Class Renewal. Most people would likely, if a recession occurred, experience less hardship. There would be more shock absorbers available, Bruno said. We think there's a real high probability that there would be less stress on families and on workers and on businesses. Inflation and the economy were key issues during the recent presidential campaign, with divergent views on which party's platform was more likely to put the U.S. on the road to recession. Bruno said national politics, however, played no part in the Illinois recession study, which was undertaken before either party had even chosen a candidate, much less formulated an economic plan. A national recession is going to be felt everywhere if it happens, Bruno said. Illinois is better prepared to deal with it than they were. You can't prevent it, but you can do better. In our B section today of the paper, we have recipes for Taste of Tradition. Bolognese sauce with fresh pasta is worth the time and effort. From the kitchen, air fryer is great for grilled cheese. Method yields golden and gooey sandwiches. Tangy potato salad the Southern German way. For the complete recipes and instructions, see the in-print version of the Decatur Herald and Review. From our Briefly column, Trump Transition. President-elect Donald Trump made more nominee announcements Tuesday. Among them was the selection of Federal Trade Commission member Andrew Ferguson to lead the agency. 2020 election. Wisconsin prosecutors filed 10 additional felony charges Tuesday against two attorneys and an aide to President-elect Donald Trump, who advised Trump in 2020 as part of a plan to submit paperwork falsely claiming he won the battleground state that year. Mideast wars. Israel carried out a wave of heavy airstrikes across Syria as its troops advanced deeper into the country, a Syrian opposition war monitor said Tuesday, and the Israeli defense minister announced his forces had destroyed Syria's navy. Federal judges. House Republicans teed up a vote this week on bipartisan legislation to expand the number of federal judgeships by 66. Democrats are balking now that President-elect Donald Trump won a second term, and the White House said Tuesday that President Joe Biden would veto the bill if it passes. McConnell. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, 82, fell and sprained his wrist while walking out of a GOP luncheon Tuesday in Washington, but he, quote, has been cleared to resume his schedule, unquote, his office said. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, December 11th. Please stay tuned.